Adam and Eve get a lot of blame for having introduced things like deceit, sin, and death, all because they ate an apple. But Bruce Feiler feels we're missing a lot about the Bible's first couple and their all-too-familiar story, and that they have something to teach us about relationships today. The PBS host and New York Times columnist has followed his bestsellers, Walking the Bible and Abraham, with the first love story, Adam, Eve, and Us. It's published by Penguin Books, and I'm very pleased it has brought Bruce Feiler back to our show. Hello.
Hello, Leonard. I just love your show, and I'm always honored to be here. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for saying that. It's been a while since you've written a book. What made you decide to tackle this couple?
For me, my process really begins at the kitchen table. I have a working wife. I have adolescent daughters, as you know, who will be 12 in a few weeks. And that means, like everybody else, I spend a huge amount of time talking about the thing that confuses us all, which is how men and women relate to each other, right? This tumultuous time of change. And, you know, I write a lot about this in my New York Times column, and it's always the latest research or the latest app. And yet, like a lot of people, I think, is there nothing from the past that's worth preserving, right? I tweet, but I Talmud too. And we were in the Sistine Chapel a few years ago. We were tracking along on a business trip with my wife to Rome. And I was like, okay, I'm going to show my sleep-deprived daughter some art. And it didn't go well. They were complaining. And I was like, got them into the chapel. I'm like, look up, girls. I'm going to blow your mind. And one of them looks at Adam and God on the ceiling and says, well, where am I in that picture? And though my mother was an art teacher, my other one looks and shows something I had never seen, which is under God's arm, there's a woman. And she says, is that Eve? And that's when I realized that this story has been at the heart of every conversation about men and women for 3,000 years. And as odd as it sounds, maybe they have something to teach us.
And not only Michelangelo, but also pretty much every other artist from the Renaissance on, until abstract art came into popularity. And so many writers. We have Milton, we have Hemingway, a whole bunch of people.
That was the real pleasure of this. As you know, I'm an experientialist, and where am I going to go, right? I can, the Garden of Eden in Iraq, you know, I went there. But Jerusalem, there's a few things, but there was nothing to see. But when I start pulling strings, this entire kind of counterculture story of all of these people, you mentioned Michelangelo, Milton,
Mary
Shelley.
Mark Twain, I left out.
Oh my God, the Mark Twain Diaries of Adam and Eve. It's the most romantic thing. Hemingway, you mentioned Beyonce, Pope Francis. So that's what Dylan, you know, sort of. So this sort of counter narrative to the religious story of sin and death was the beauty of the relationship. And so I kind of got to go on this sort of, I think of it as the ultimate Adam and Eve road trip. And that really was where the journey took me, to see all those people and how they talked about the story.
What had been your own perceptions about them before you started working on the book?
I think that, you know, I think that people think of one of two things. One is it's sort of a fairy tale, right? And we've moved on, we know better. And I would say I was in the camp of, because, you know, from Walking the Bible, I was the land kind of person, and there was not a lot of places to go. And so I didn't really think about it because it didn't echo the part of the Bible that I've been most engaged in. Or people, we get in this conversation about kind of creationism, which is also sort of a sidetrack. You know, who knows if they existed then, but we know they exist now because of all these people who have encountered them. And I think that I probably viewed, like a lot of people, the story negatively. And I think that the number one thing I learned is if you go back to the original story, first of all, it's a revelation. There's not one story, as you know. There's two. And the second story, that's all the famous stuff. That's the Adam being created from the earth and Eve from his side and the
from
fruit.
From his rib.
What?
From his ribs.
But it's not his rib, as you know. It's this, because that's the interpretation. It's a Selah in Hebrew. That's side. They stand side by side. So part of it, and the first story, they're totally created equal, right? God creates this ungendered human being, divides it into two. What's true for Adam is true for Eve. There's total equality. But what happened was, organized religion got a hold of the story and basically dumped on Eve. I mean, it's I think of it as the greatest character assassination the world has ever known. And you have to almost go back behind the male commentariat to the original story to find the lessons for today.
Didn't early rabbis and church fathers have issues with Eve?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that they singled her out. I mean, think of Paul saying, you know, you don't have to trust the woman was created second, so she's secondary. The man should have control. Well, first of all, that's not true. In Genesis 1, they created simultaneously. And second, in the Bible, Phyllis Trible, the great feminist interpreter of the Bible, used to point out that the animals are created first, but they're not superior. So in the Bible, what's second is often first. So Eve is not an afterthought. She's the culmination.
How do you get around the idea that Eve's the one who is held responsible for listening to the serpent and not only eating from the apple, but then encouraging Adam to eat from it?
Well, I think that that is actually kind of a key moment. To me, that's one of the great love moments. So what happens is, okay, so they're equal in Genesis 1. In Genesis 2, Adam is created, then Eve created from his side. They're side by side. The Bible says they're naked and know no shame.
And so, why do you think the story was told twice?
Well, I think that maybe to show that there's two points of the story. There's a lot of duality in the text. And I think in this case, you've got two people, Adam and Eve, right? Theirs is the first joint byline. And I actually think having two stories, you know, suggests that there are different ways of understanding it. But Eve doesn't, and they're in love, right? Adam looks at her and says, she's the one, right? You have this ecstatic outpouring. But she doesn't, she's bored. She wants autonomy. She wants agency. We now know that from social science, that we want to be motivated by self-directedness. So she goes off and eats. What is the fruit? It's the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. So she wants knowledge. She's the first to lean in, the first independent woman. And then she could stay apart, but she realizes, well, she wants autonomy, but she also wants a relationship. Milton has her in this moment saying, so dear, I love Adam. And she goes back to Adam. He also has choice. He can choose duty or companionship. He chooses companionship. They choose each other. That's actually the great love moment at the beginning of the story.
You credit Augustine with seeing the sex part being a bad thing.
Right.
And then there's the whole matter of them being ashamed that they're naked.
Right. So the Jews in particular kind of celebrate the sexuality. And even early Christian, the church fathers, there was a great debate. Should this be viewed as a sin, or should this be viewed as healthy sexuality? Augustine, who of course brought his own agenda, he had been raised by a Christian mother, but then he became a pagan and he had a child out of wedlock. He's the one who said, her sin is all of our sin. And a lot of people pushed back, but of course, ultimately that prevailed. So for the next 1,000 years, really until the Protestant Reformation, there was this sort of sex negative view about Adam and Eve. And I think that one of the things that's happened, certainly in the last couple hundred years, is a converting and a recognizing, even in evangelicals today, that there is a very sex positive message there. So they look each other with their eyes.
What's the significance of the phrase opening their eyes?
Yeah, exactly. Well, I think, first of all, here's the Bible understanding what we now know is that a glance, right, can make you fall in love. I mean, the romantic novelists, they all kind of loved this, from Les Miserables to Thomas Hardy. I mean, the idea, we think of it now, like, you know, it all is captured in the eyes. But even there, the two of them know no shame. They begin as two before the fruit and the sexual encounter. They are two. The text is very clear that sexuality, as we know, brings them together. We now know, of course, it releases endorphins and all these chemicals. The sexual union brings them closer together. And then even when they leave Eden, they stay together, then they have children. That doesn't work out. They come together and have a third child.
So it's kind of the birth of their consciousness.
And what consciousness is the recognition that humans are separate from God. I mean, let's just step back for a second, Leonard, and just talk about what I think is also, why is this book called The First Love Story? In all other stories in the ancient world, I'm talking Mesopotamia and Egypt, you had a god and a god create the humans, or a god and a human. The Bible is a revolution in thought. It's the first story that has a human and a human at the start of the human line. So you've got one God gives the power of procreation to humans. The first thing God says, the first commandment to humans is be fruitful and multiply. He needs them to succeed. And even when he kicks them out of Eden, he covers them in protective clothes. He wants them to work this out. The question of the story is, can they find a way to work it out?
My guest is Bruce Feiler, whose latest book is The First Love Story, Adam, Eve, and Us. Well, they wind up having a couple of kids, and that doesn't turn out well.
Yet another insight that the Bible has.
Did that affect their marriage?
I love this question. I'm so glad you asked this question. The commentators did not ask this question. It's such a small matter in the history of the discussion of the story, yet it's so huge. How did this affect their relationship? We all think, I mean, if we took a poll of your listeners right now, do you think losing a child is bad for a marriage? My guess is we'd get 90%+ would say yes.
Especially if one of your children has killed the other one.
Well, you know, that's why there's Sue Klebold in this book, because what you can learn about from having a child who's a murderer. But I interviewed this woman who is a former nurse at Oregon, who followed 300 families from Mount St. Helens who lost children for decades, and only a dozen broke up. It's simply not true. How do they survive? What she said is the first couple of years are difficult. You're mourning yourself, and you're protecting yourself. And then you look across the table, so to speak, and you realize that the person across from you is also suffering, and you realize what this story teaches us, that love is the story you tell with another person, and you have to heal together, write a new chapter in your story, and keep moving forward. And that's what they do. The greatest moment of all in this, like Eliza and Alexander Hamilton, they come together, they forgive. What's the last line in It's Quiet Uptown? Forgiveness, who can imagine? The imaginativeness is the way you respond to the unimaginable in a relationship.
And do you see them as being equal throughout their relationship?
No, I see them as a back and forth, which I think is even more powerful and more relevant, right? Adam is created first, but then he clings to her. Adam initiates the lovemaking that has the children. She names the children. To me, it's like, we talk about equality. I quote Helen Fisher, in the end of this book. We talk about equality. What we really want is equilibrium in a relationship. This one's better in the kitchen. That one's better with the kids. This one's better with the housework. That one's better paying the bills. They have a kind of back and forth. Equilibrium is the word that I like. A counterbalance here that I think is very reflective of today. There is not one dominant. They both are dominant at different times.
Where'd the notion of a Lilith come from?
Look, I don't think you'd have... I mean, who could imagine Adam and Eve being around for 3,000 years without a sex scandal? I mean, it's going to happen, right? So you've got Lilith. By the way, I've been working on this book for 3 years. The number one question is, do you write about Lilith? Yes, she gets a whole chapter in the first love story. And so their idea is he had a wife, of course, before Eve. That's the Lilith story. And what did they fight about? He wanted to be on top and she didn't want to be underneath when they had sexual relations. And so she goes off and she then becomes a baby snatcher. You can still find on Etsy today amulets that will keep Lilith away. And so he has a dalliance with Lilith. She has a dalliance with the snake. They're equal.
Except that she either comes from his side or they are split apart. How are people being blasphemous when they consider that Adam had an earlier wife?
No, I think that they are expressing. I think when Lilith arises in the Middle Ages, I think that there is this tension. It's the Madonna whore complex. We talk about it today, right? So there's this, Eve slowly became elevated over time to kind of liken her to Mary. That's why she's in the center of the Sistine Chapel, not Adam and God. It's the next image that's in the center of the Sistine Chapel. But what are you going to do with the kind of the dark sexuality that men wanted to warn fellow men about? That's really where Lilith begins to arise.
Now, most of the research here is through literature, books, yep, et cetera. You even include Mae West in it.
Oh, I love that story.
You want to tell it?
Oh, it's great. It's a quick story. In December 1937, she's on the Chasen Sanborn radio hour in a skit about Eve. She plays Eve. Don Ameche plays Adam. Charlie McCarthy plays the snake. Okay? And she totally, of course, it got past the censors. I mean, it's such a radio story, by the way. Here we are on radio. It gets past the censors, but she's like, oh, I just created an original sin. Like, oh, I just made a little history, right? I'm going to make some applesauce. But it was the first, what's relevant about it is, the first time there was an organized religious backlash to her pop culture, and she was banned from radio for life for daring to suggest that Eve had her own sexual interest.
When you were researching it, did you come up with a place that might have been the site of the Garden of Eden?
Well, this is so timely. Of course, you were talking about Iraq before I came on. Look, there are four rivers, the Bible says. Two of them we know, they're the Tigris and Euphrates. Two of them we don't know. So, and given that Abraham right afterwards is born in Ur of the Chaldees, which is in southern Iraq, I think the likeliest place is at the confluence of the Tigris and Euphrates. In fact, if you go there today, as I did in the middle of the war, there's a little garden about the size of the studio we're in now. And it's about, maybe the size of two New York taxi cabs. There's three living olive trees and one dead one. And it's easy to romanticize, if you will. This is the Garden of Eden. But the truth is Saddam diverted the river. So they've only actually met there for about 15 years.
What did you make of Pope Francis's prepared remarks to the Festival of Families? Were you surprised?
What an amazing night that was. So I was hired by CNN to cover the Pope. And so we had traveled for a week. We're there in Philadelphia. There's a million people stretched out on that causeway. And because in the media, as you know, they give out the... So he prepares this thing, which is all about Adam and Eve. Being in love, we need love in families today. I looked at this, like I was live on the air, and I looked on this, and I was like, oh my God, this is the story of Adam and Eve that I've been piecing together for centuries. This is going to be the end of my, I mean, for centuries, for 2 years. This is going to be the end of my book.
Just felt like centuries.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you very much. And the thing runs late. He scraps the organized speech, which no one was upset about except me. And then he gives this sort of virtuoso, like he's the preacher from the Barrios, but talking about love, talking about the power of family. And that's the change here. There's the change. Like the Catholic Church, which had dumped on Eve, now is embracing Eve because love and family are at the conversation of what people are struggling now. And religion has realized that that's really the centerpiece of religion. It's not buildings anymore. It's kitchen tables.
Bruce Feiler will be discussing his book tonight at 7 at the Barnes & Noble store at 150 East 86th Street. And then tomorrow night at 6:15, he will be at the Brooklyn Heights Synagogue at 131 Remsen Street. His book, The First Love Story, Adam, Eve, and Us, is published by Penguin Press. And I guess you're looking at the Bible for some more material?
I just believe that our phones are not going to give us the answer. We need timely knowledge, but we also need timeless wisdom.
It's always a pleasure having you on our show. Thank you so much for coming by again.
The pleasure is mine. Thank you, Leonard.